Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Hey there, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you today?
I have a food hangover. I do. I don't have an alcohol hangover. I have a food hangover.
You went on a little dessert safari in Manhattan last night.
Yeah.
Francis gives me a call at about 12:05. He's like, oh, my God, I'm going to throw up. I ate too much dessert. And then I didn't tell you this, but you went with the chef last night, and I walked out of the restaurant, and chef was coming off the train from New York City as I left the restaurant.
Yeah.
And he was like, I must have had 200 non-sugar calories today. I feel like crap.
Oh, the executive chef of both of our restaurants and the sous chef of Stage Left. We decided to go out on a little dessert safari because we're looking for inspirations for our fall dessert menu. And we said, you know, one of the interesting things that's happening in New York is, here's something that Chef Anthony Bucco said last night that I thought was very interesting. He said, you know, I wish I'd gone to pastry school and been a pastry chef instead of a chef, which, of course, he doesn't really mean. because pastry chefs are a very unique type of person. It's a different environment. I mean, the pastry chef is a person who usually gets there first thing in the morning while it's all quiet, and the kitchen's still cool. So
and clean. The kitchen's perfectly clean. All the pots are clean. All the floors are clean. There's nobody in your way. It's not too hot yet.
Now, when you're cooking, a kitchen, of course, is clean, but you're fabricating meats, and you're, and there's, you know, things are spraying, and you got pans.
Right, there's no pots and pans that are dirty in your way. Anything you want to use is ready for you. It's right in front of you.
And in pastry, the temperature has to be perfect. The measurements are perfect. There's no pinch or dash of anything. and it's more chemistry than anything else. It's totally different temperament. And, you know, chef said, you know, if there are 5 great pastry chefs in the Northeast, that would be that's where both Anthony and Jason would put it. And I agree. And we went out last night. We went looking for, you know, good and great desserts.
Right.
And what you're seeing happen in New York, we talked with Antoinette Bruno from Star Chefs about this when she was on. You're seeing dessert bars, places that specialize in dessert, come out more in cities like New York, but across the country as well.
And years ago, you would go to Little Italy, and you could and you'd have dinner somewhere, and then you'd go to Ferrara's and get a cannoli or something like that, like a pastry shop,
Cafe Roma,
and do those kinds of things. But this is kind of a different phenomenon that's emerging, where it's an actual sit down kind of a dessert place, place where you have one course or maybe two courses of dessert, and it's more formalized.
One of the places that's getting a lot of press is called Chickalicious. It's opened by two women. I found out last night is that it's closed on Mondays and Tuesdays. Super. Chickalicious was closed last night. We didn't go there, but it looked great from the outside. We also went to Hearth Restaurant, which is a great restaurant that they have. We had a great we sat and had dessert at the bar, which is becoming increasingly more common. But we went to a couple of places that are known specifically for their dessert. One of the best dessert chefs in the country, or pastry chefs in the country, is a guy named Sam Mason. And Sam Mason is at WD50, where Wiley DuFrenz is chef. And Sam Mason is about to open his own place, which is as yet unnamed. And we went and had
maybe he'll name it Ad Hoc. Oh, no. Thomas Keller's doing that already.
We went down to WD50 and sat at the bar and had 7 desserts among the three of us. And they were really very striking, is that there was as much care placed on those desserts as there were on any savory course. And that was very interesting. Those desserts, very avant-garde, very unusual desserts. And then we went to another place called...
Did you like them? Were they something that you would want to eat all the time?
Two of them were extraordinary that I would want to eat all the time. And the others were very good. So, I mean, and frankly, I like, no offense to Wiley, but I like dessert at WD-50 better than I like anything else. I mean, it's just so extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and it was funny because I was sitting at, we were sitting at the bar at WD-50 having dessert, and there was a young woman sitting at the bar having dessert. And we just struck up a conversation with her. Turns out she's a pastry cook in Chicago.
Interesting.
Who just come to New York for the final interview of a job she took as a pastry cook. She's going back to Chicago. She's going to find a place in New York and move to New York and work in the pastry. And I thought that was very exciting for a young woman to come and be entering the culinary world in New York. She was very excited about it. And she was on a culinary tour of great desserts in Manhattan. And we said, well, where else are you going? She said, well, next I'm going to a place called Room for Desserts, which is exactly where we were going next.
That's
and
funny.
So we found another safari-er on the way. And the place called Room for Desserts is owned by a guy named Will Goldfarb, who used to be Craig Shelton's pastry chef at the Ryland Inn here in New Jersey. Craig Shelton, great chef in New Jersey. And it is just a dessert bar. You go there, and you have a menu of dessert cocktails, which is interesting. They're not really cocktails. They're not really alcoholic, but
they're more like dessert.
It's a deconstructed pina colada, very light. It's like in the summertime, that's very appropriate. You know, pineapple sorbet, pieces of pineapple, coconut in there, coconut foam in there, and it's the flavors of a pina colada. But it's really done. It sounds like it could be hokey, right? Really done excellently well, and it's just a long bar where you can go and, say, have two courses of dessert and coffee.
The deconstructed pina colada, though, is really a tightrope to walk because you really could fall on the wrong side.
Yeah. No, but Will Goldfarb does it really well. I think you can find it online at roomfordessert.com. If not, we'll link to it on our website. But he really was terrific. We had 7 desserts there as well.
Excellent. So you had 14 desserts last night.
No, that was only two places. And they were brilliant. And some things familiar, like the deconstructed pina colada, but you're finding a lot of people using things like a beet ice cream, which in as a component of many desserts, that's an unusual flavor, but it's not crazy. And,
right.
and if you try it, it can be worked to very good advantage. And so Room for Dessert, I highly recommend it. So we had 14 desserts in those two places. And then we went to Falai, which is a guy named Jacopo Falai, downtown, way downtown.
Jacopo Popo?
Jacopo Falai. I got stuck there. And he has a restaurant there, but he started as a dessert shop. And now he has Falai and Falai Panetteria, where they do fabulous desserts as well.
So he's added a restaurant based on his dessert bar.
So it was 14 desserts there. Then we did Hearth, and then we just came home and had little convulsions.
I'm going to tell you, I saw Chef in the street, and he looked really bad.
Oh.
He looked really like he had overdone sugar. Anyway, a little bit into the show, we're going to have a guy by the name of Stephen Ranella, who's going to talk about the Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine, which is fascinating. And if you've never had the good fortune to go and scavenge for something, or go mussling or clamming and eat that right away, or crabbing or fishing or hunting, or it's really a very much more dynamic way, I think, to connect to food.
I have to say, I really like his book.
Yeah.
And the Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine, and you just use the word scavenge. I prefer forage. I'm going to go with forage. Scavenge has a connotation of the dumpster diving.
One of the worst experiences of my life, going out to my aunt's place in Long Island when I was 19 or so years old, clamming.
Uh-huh.
Getting all the clams, spending all day clamming, took them to my brother's house, making stuffed clams out of them.
Huh?
Awful. Awful. One of the worst food experiences
of
my life.
Bad clams. Sorry.
So it goes.
All right. When we come back from the break, we're going to be talking with Stephen Ranella about his wonderful book, his first book called The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine, about his quest to come up with a 45-course meal from Auguste Escoffier. It took him a year to do it, and it's pretty exciting stuff. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Stephen Ranella. Stephen has written for The New Yorker, Nerve, and Double Take. He's a nature writer, a correspondent for Outside Magazine, and his work has been featured in the best American travel writing. His book, his first book, is the tremendous The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine.
Hey, Stephen, how are you today?
Hey, I'm doing great.
Welcome to the show.
Stephen,
thank you very much.
I have to say, just from looking at the cover of the book, which is which is a picture of an oven with a, looks like a raccoon tail,
sticking out
of the oven,
and a pot on top.
I knew that I was going to like this book, and I wound up liking it. Why don't you tell people the premise of the book and how you sort of uniquely brought together your own experiences and culinary tradition here?
All right. Well, I'm going to preface this with saying that that's the one animal, maybe the one animal you will not find in that book, is a raccoon.
Excellent.
So I don't know what, you know. It's a nice cover, but there's no raccoon. So if you look through it thinking you're going to get a lot of great raccoon information,
I'm going to tell you something, Stephen. I got all the raccoon information I need.
Yeah, especially,
they occasionally traipse through my garbage cans. I get the special cans that seal. That's it. I'm done.
Well, let's bring the listeners up to speed on what exactly The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine is all about. Now, it's about a hunting and gathering quest where you take a year-long adventure in pursuit of preparing a 3-day, 45-course meal. Basically based on, you know, Escoffier Legit Culinaire, which is about sort of antique food. So whatever prompted
which is
you...
one of the, and everybody who's out there should know that Escoffier's book is one of the Bibles of, you know, fine
French.
Dining and French cooking and the kind of the start of that type of cuisine.
What prompted?
Yeah, I had never, when I was introduced to, well, obviously before you're introduced to something you've never heard of it, but I had never heard of Escoffier until a couple years ago, and I had come into possession of a 15-pound snapping turtle. I had eaten a lot of fried snapping turtles as a kid, but I told my mom, you know, I was interested in getting a new one. My mom called me up in Michigan. I was living in Montana at the time, and she called me up and said that she had caught a turtle for me, and she had it in a shed and was, you know, fed and watered. And I was going out for a visit, so I'm like, well, I knew I was going to bring the turtle home. And back to Montana, and I was going to have a party for my friends and stuff and cook the turtle, but I wanted to do something kind of cool with it besides just frying it up, you know.
Cersei so, Almadira, awesome combination with turtle.
So, well, yeah, I had previously only had them dipped in frying magic and deep fried in a deep fryer. Uh-huh. So a friend of mine says, well, you know, I have this cookbook which has these kind of like interesting turtle preparations in it. And she didn't really know anything about the cookbook either, but she gave it to me, and it was Escoffier's The Culinary Guide, or as you... so eloquently, you know, you're able to do the French. I don't even attempt the French anymore.
Guys from Montana, don't do the French. I got it. Okay, go ahead.
So it's a Escoffier's Culinary Guide. And I thumbed through the book, and I was kind of almost alarmed at how vividly he portrays the process of how to butcher a turtle. And as I looked through the book, there's a lot of items in there that, you know, people don't eat anymore. If you wanted to eat them, you wouldn't be able to buy them anyway.
Why don't you give us some examples of things beside turtle like that?
Okay, for instance, perhaps because of technology and things they had and didn't have, would explain some of these. For instance, Escoffier would poach birds inside of animal bladders.
Mm-hmm.
He would use, he would collect his own marrow out of femurs.
Mm-hmm.
He would eat or have, he would offer preparations for literally every part of a pig.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, lungs, nose, ears, feet, tail.
Well, the tradition was that you ate the entire animal. I mean, you didn't waste anything. It was too precious and too valuable.
And you know,
oh yeah, there was like a real sense of. But that's the thing with him that really intrigued me, because Escoffier's moniker, like his handle, was that he was the King of Chefs and the Chef of Kings. And now the crescendo of his career sort of occurred in pre-World War I Europe, and he cooked for the jet-setting crowd, and an extravagantly wealthy crowd, all the royalty that, like, before World War I kind of destroyed this world, like, all the royalty that would just kind of hang around being royalty with no real, honest obligations to do anything. And they were so wealthy, so when Escoffier cooked, it wasn't that he was trying to, like, just be really thrifty and use every part of an ingredient. It was just that he was trying to be, I mean, he would hate this term, but he almost had an obligation to be somewhat outrageous or somewhat innovative, you know, and always provide new tastes and new flavors.
But it wasn't even just that. It was a respect for the animal itself.
I would say so. And it reminded me of, like, indigenous hunters, how, like, indigenous hunters here in North America, you know, would really utilize every little aspect of an animal, but they did it you know, for a different set of needs, but it really kind of brought that to mind.
You know? Well, and you know, every once in a while you just have a craving for a pig lung, and you just, you know, you gotta know how to cook it up. So
pig lights are what they're called there.
So you then had this party and carved up this turtle for your friends.
Yeah, well, I had a little party. Mm-hmm. I had a little party and did the turtle, and the turtle, it was terrible. And through Escoffier, I learned why that turtle was terrible. And then, after having botched the first turtle, the turtle had not been properly flushed in clean water mm-hmm. after being held in captivity for a couple weeks. Now, then I thought, okay, now I'm going to back up, and I'm going to really do this right.
And actually, before we get into it, because it sounds like we're about to get into the meat of the matter, we're going to take a quick break for a commercial. We're going to come back and talk more with Stephen Ranella about he went out and scavenged for over a year to put together a 45-course meal based on Escoffier. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
Today we are proud to present Jackie Naylor.
Once upon a time, New Year's Eve was a night for swank jazz, champagne, and caviar. Ring in 2007 at just such a gathering with us. The Restaurant Guys present a New Year's Eve jazz concert at the Crossroads Theater starring Ms. Jackie Naylor. Jackie's been called the new voice of jazz by Vogue magazine. Jazz Times says, in the never-ending Next Big Thing sweepstakes, bet on Jackie Naylor. She's headlined internationally, she's played with Michael McDonald and David Sanborn, and on New Year's Eve, she'll play to a sold-out crowd at the Crossroads Theater right next to our restaurants. Dine before or after the show at either one of our acclaimed restaurants. There are hotel accommodations within walking distance, one of the best jazz singers in the country, two of the best restaurants in the state, an evening not to be forgotten. Go to stageleft.com or Catherine Lombardi.com for details, reservations, and menus, or call 732-828-4444. Put the swank back in New Year's Eve. Spend it with the Restaurant Guys. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis, our guest today, Stephen Ranella. His book is The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine, how he went and scavenged to put together a 45-course meal full of all kinds of crazy stuff that's really not widely eaten or available anymore, based on Auguste Escoffier's Le Guide Culinaire. Now, Stephen, we were talking about your first foray into following Escoffier, where you took this turtle, and you sort of inexpertly followed the advice of Escoffier, and you didn't have such great success.
That's right.
Tell us about that and how that made you decide to that you were going to go and really, you know, bite this in the butt.
I think that after the turtle was so terrible, it was almost funny how bad it was. Mm-hmm. Then I kind of thought like, if you're going to do this, you know, you really got to follow it quite closely. So, you got to follow his advice quite closely. And then I thought, well, you know, if I'm going to really do it, then I'll really do it and I'd have like a large party where maybe I'd bring friends out from all over the country. And so then I kind of started thinking that rather than just trying to cook one Escoffier thing, I might try to cook 45 Escoffier dishes. So that's why I started spending a year gathering up all the things one would need.
And that's why it took a year.
Yeah. So from that you went on, and did you, while gathering this stuff together to make this Escoffier meal, this Escoffier feast, did you cook things along the way to sort of practice your technique?
Yeah, a little bit at first. And what I did was there's like a dish called Troutau Bleu, or, you know, blue trout. So I went up in the mountains and set up a camp. And the part of cooking blue trout is that the trout's supposed to be almost alive, you know. Like, mm-hmm. you just thump it on the head and throw it in the vinegar, hot mm-hmm. vinegar. So I went up in the mountains, set up a camp, caught a trout, thunked it, did that. And it worked, you know, because, like, what Escoffier describes is the skin will turn, like, a really vibrant blue and break into this kind of mosaic of, like, blue against pink, you know. Hmm. And I did it, and, like, it worked expertly. Like, I've never seen it. It was almost like doing, like a really satisfying chemistry experience, experiment, you know. And so that kind of pumped me up.
Actually, we're gonna have to take a break for the news, but when we come back, we're going to talk with Stephen Ranella, author of The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine, which you can find out about on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. You can even pick it up there. And so if you're tempted to be a crazy person yourself and do this. And we're going to talk about how he spent a year putting together every chef's dream, a 45-course meal based on Auguste Escoffier's guide, Le Guide Culinaire, with all these crazy things in it that only an outdoorsman could do. Back after the news, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capo Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Stephen Ranella is our guest today. His book is called The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine, which is based on a 45-course meal that he put together based on Auguste Escoffier's Culinary Guide, which is in every important kitchen everywhere. It's the basis of modern haute cuisine, which is the basis of most methods of cooking. But the Guy Culinaire, or Escoffier's book, is full of these wild recipes with a lot of things that we don't eat anymore. And it's every chef's secret dream to go out and actually cook these things, you know, go and find them and cook them. And Stephen, you did that. Let me ask before, I want to ask sort of what this meal was about and what kind of crazy things you cooked there. What was the most outrageous, you think, course of dinner that you wound up cooking?
I would say the most out of the 45 things, I think that it's hard to say which one was most outrageous, but probably a dish where you take a whole carp. And
a whole what?
A whole carp.
A whole carp. Okay.
Yep, carp. And Escoffier has you chop his head and tail off, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Then remove all the meat from the carp.
Okay.
Then you mix it with other kinds of forest meat made of other sorts of fishes. And you mix it with cream and butter and all sorts of things. And you put a little white wine in there to loosen it up. And then you remold the body of the carp.
Like after you've taken it off the bones,
you add new things to it. So now you rebuild a carp.
You make it look like a carp again. With
put
the,
his head and tail back
meat.
On.
Mm-hmm.
And then make scales out of truffles. So you rescale the carp with truffles.
You know those are my favorite scales, right?
Yeah, truffle scales. $1,800 a pound.
And then you sort of float him in a little ocean of poached oysters.
Oh, my.
And, you know, and then, as you can imagine, I did not eat the carp's head and tail. I mean, I would have, but I didn't. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was, you know, that's kind of, it's like there's your day cut out for you right there.
Yeah. So how did you put together a 45-course meal based on this sort of labor-intensive stuff? Did you have a lot of friends come and help you?
Yeah, I did. I had about, every night I had, it took 3 nights to do it. So to say like a 45-course meal is in some ways deceiving because it was a 3-night deal. Every night we'd start serving. I would have 2 or 3 people to help me in the kitchen all day. We'd get up at 6 in the morning. And I did 2 weeks of prep before it even started.
Mm-hmm.
It occurred over Thanksgiving weekend, so we'd get up, you know, 6 or 7 in the morning, start cooking, start serving around 7 at night, and the meals would last till about midnight. And then the next day we'd get up, usually my friends would go off hunting or whatever, and then a couple new people would help out in the kitchen, and we would start all over again. And we did 15 courses a night.
Now, I asked you what was the most outrageous course. What was the most difficult thing to source, or what were some of the unusual things that you were like, well, you know, that the normal person would say, how am I going to get that?
So many of the things that you write about in the book are just, you know, the average person is just not going to.
You're not going to find them in aisle 9 at the supermarket.
Yeah, well, it's funny because things that I thought would be difficult sometimes are very easy, and some things I thought that would be very easy proved to be very difficult. Now, for instance, I hunt elk, okay, quite a bit. Like, part of my normal annual routine is to hunt elk.
Mm-hmm.
So some people might think, like, to get an elk femur to make marrow bone
mm-hmm.
would be, you know, a difficult thing to get. But for me, it's like, you know, I can go up. Like, so we went up, my brother and I went up, spent, you know, 7-8 days in the mountains bow hunting for elk, killed elk. So there's 7-8 days down the drain
right.
So I got my elk femur. On the other hand, to get a baby street pigeon, a squab, as outlined by Escoffier, he has very rigid standards for what makes a squab acceptable for food. I spent a year of all, I was like perpetually looking for a squab.
What now, you can buy squab commercially. How do Escoffier's definition of a squab differ from what's commercially available?
Oh, no, it doesn't differ than what's commercially available. The premise of the whole deal was that I would
personally have to hunt and gather.
Collect everything.
Right.
So what do you have to do to find a squab in the wild?
You can't go to Greekstown Quail Farm and buy a squab?
You go to Central Park in New York and find a squab if you wouldn't care about what kind.
I know. At first, I was like, I thought that, well, first, Escoffier says it has to be less than a year old and have never flown, okay? But a squab in nature flies at about 28 days.
Mm-hmm.
They have a 28-day incubation. They're hatched. They fly in 28 days. So the window is very small.
Uh-huh.
And initially, and like now I would probably be able to do it very quickly, but initially I was like, okay, I'll go. And I collected seven of them. I was living in a basement apartment in Missoula, Montana. I went out and caught seven adult pigeons. Put them all in a little aviary that I built in my apartment,
uh-huh.
thinking that they would pair off and breed. But no, like, no romantic interest
they weren't attracted,
up between
they
any
weren't
two
attracted
of
to each other?
No, and it's like, and if you have seven, you'd have to assume statistically that there's a male and female.
Right.
So then I went out and got eggs, okay, out of other nests and put the eggs in there thinking that someone might foster those
mm-hmm.
eggs.
Mm-hmm.
They did not. Then I went and found a pair that I actually was, I watched a pair of pigeons every day fornicating on a roof. Caught those two pigeons.
You understand that most people in America are making fun of you, right?
You're a serious dude, man. Go ahead. So you caught the two mating pigeons.
And put them in my aviary.
Yeah.
And their romance died.
Well, you know, the fun had gone out of it.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. So eventually what I wound up doing was
Very hard to do that on display. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah, well, they were pretty obvious up on the peak of a roof, you know, in an urban area. But what I wound up doing was going out and just getting little hatchlings
uh-huh.
out of nests. Now, let me preface by saying the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service would like to see pigeons extirpated from the U.S. They're a non-native bird. So it's like the one bird, and nowhere is it protected.
Okay.
So I'm not being a bad guy.
Right. We got it.
But I pulled the little nestlings out and brought them home and put bird seed in a coffee grinder. Ground it up, mixed it with half and half, and I was feeding these things with an eyedropper. But then I had a cat kill some. I had some get stolen, literally stolen from me.
Who steals baby squab?
Other Escoffier cookbook guy?
I was keeping them at a guy's place, and we got in a fight, and he got rid of them.
I thought maybe PETA came and took your squab away before you could.
Okay. So did this finally work? Is that where your squab came from?
That's how I wound up getting the squabs.
Darn.
Hand raising them.
That's great. Now that brings us to another topic. You talk about sourcing a number of the animal based ingredients that you get, sort of having an attachment to the animals. How do you? Has this given you a greater appreciation for? I mean, you're obviously a hunter anyway. You're an outdoorsman anyway. But has this given you a greater appreciation for food and how connected we are to our food, to humane methods of animal husbandry, things like that?
Oh, absolutely, man. And I've always had a love affair with what you might call the more romantic animals,
mm-hmm.
like large, like elk and bears and deer, you know. Like, I always look at those and I get like a, almost kind of like of a spiritual sense of abundance, you know,
mm-hmm.
to be around animals. I just like to be around them, see them. I get a sense of, like, that's where my nourishment comes from.
Right.
But working on this book kind of opened my eyes to a lot of things. I mean, it enhanced the feeling I was discussing about large animals. But then, like, things like carp, okay, and street pigeons, and American eels, all these things that people might look at them and think, like, that they're gross, or that, you know, people call pigeons flying rats.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but all these things that are sort of overlooked or disdained or ignored are, in a way, these kind of, like, beautiful food sources, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the biggest sense of the thing I got is that it really expanded my view of what the beautiful animals are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what I think a lot of people don't realize, too, is even the animals that we don't generally eat are still part of that chain. They're still part of that whole, you know, ecosystem.
Oh, yeah. There's like a, you know, there's a sacredness to them. And at the same time, a lot of these animals are the ones, and the ones that this project kind of awakened me to are the ones that don't mind living by us.
Uh-huh.
You know? I mean, like, in an urban atmosphere, like, I spend a lot of time underneath a bridge, you know, in towns looking for crayfish and pigeons and stuff. And you kind of, like, I kind of, like, develop this sense of affection will be company to us that don't mind urban atmospheres, mm-hmm. and they're just kind of existing around, you know, and that many people not only take for granted, but also try to poison off, like,
right.
you know, pigeons. I think now, like, if you want to control pigeons,
mm-hmm.
that maybe you should control them by consuming them rather
right.
than just poisoning them with Avitrol.
And also the more ugly animals that we tend to overlook.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's like, so now I kind of like have, you know, and I haven't eaten any squabs since I did this, but now I look at a pigeon on the street, you know, and I kind of feel better about them, or kind of gives me like a nice sense. You know?
And you sort of wish you had a gun. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment with Stephen Ranella. His book is The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine. It's a great read. Check it out on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1145.
Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. Economy is the only dealer in New Jersey that's been approved for on-site demonstrations of the Rational Combi Oven. The Rational Combi Oven is an innovative combination of convection and adjustable steam oven. It's a powerful and versatile tool in your kitchen's arsenal. They also supply competitively priced paper products and all the non-food supplies every restaurant needs. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is Stephen Ranella. We're having a lot of fun talking about his book, The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine. If you have just tuned in, Stephen went out and put together 45 courses from a very old cookbook, from a pre-World War I cookbook from Auguste Escoffier, using some techniques that we really don't use anymore, and actually scavenging for all the food himself. Now, it took you a year to get the ingredients for this huge three-day feast?
Yeah, but I mean, I could have spent 3 years, you know. I mean, the book's 5,000, you know, the unabridged version is 5,012 recipes. So I went through and just made a list of everything one might feasibly get in North America.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just arbitrarily set a year. Well, I mean, not arbitrarily, because you imagine that, you know, you can only have things in your freezer so long.
Right, right,
of course.
And so I was like, okay, that's like a reasonable amount of time. It's not too long, the thing's going to go bad. And I could kind of like sequence things in such a way that maybe some of the things that were more vulnerable to spoiling I would get later on. And then, you know, a year just seemed like, I don't know, there's a certain tidiness to 1 year, you know.
So that's
why I took a year to do it.
How did the meal work out? Tell us about how you feel your 45 course 3 day
feast
fiesta. How do you feel that it worked out?
Well, it worked out fantastically. But instead of just giving you like my own assessment of it, the people that were there almost unanimously agreed. I think. Yeah, almost unanimously agreed that it was the most memorable food experience they had had.
Yeah, I can
imagine. And for me, it's like it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Like, I will never have those things again. And there's so many little, like, you go through life, and you get a sense of, like, that there's certain ways things taste, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But doing this was, like, little discoveries of all these little subtleties, you know? Of, like, different, like a duck consommé. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's done like really right and like really detailed, like a Escoffier prescribed,
it's a lot of work.
I've never tasted anything like it.
Yeah,
you know?
It's a great duck consommé. There is nothing like it.
It was unbelievable. And then like little baby street pigeons, and then I mean, just everything was such a unique experience where you'd sit down to every dish. You know, you'd sit down and it'd be like you'd kind of almost have to catch your breath about like how exciting it was to eat it. And that's something you get. Like you go into a place and get a burger. You know, you'd be like, that was a good burger based on all my experiences with burgers.
Right.
But you don't have, there's no paradigm for a lot of these items.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't go like, oh, yeah, I've had a lot of liver souffle, and that was a bad liver souffle.
Right.
You know?
I mean, great food is experiential. That's what it is. It's,
oh,
it's,
absolutely.
It's experiencing
new
things.
I mean, it's
new
like, it's as fun as going to Disneyland when you're a kid. Mm-hmm. This is like a thinking man's Disneyland to have like a meal like this.
I mean, I love when I go to a restaurant and they treat me to something that I've never seen before or had before. You know, I went recently to a restaurant called Del Posto in New York City and had a dish called Bolito Misto that had just a bunch of different flavors that I had never had before. And to me, that was fascinating and really interesting. Do you find that this has changed the way you eat and the way you cook now?
You know, I would like to think that it did, you know, in some ways it has. Like, for instance, I developed a real passion for eating marrow bones.
Mm-hmm.
Bone marrow. But I had to throw in the towel on it because I just came to the conclusion that eating that many marrow bones is probably going to kill you. I mean, it's like, you know, I think it's just cholesterol. So, little things like that, like little things that developed. But for the most part, it's just something that I carry in my mind, and I think that it gave me like a new, lot of new tools. Like my toolkit was vastly expanded. But in general, I still kind of eat the same way I ate before. I hate to say it, but I eat all game. And so now and then maybe I'm doing like, I'll do some little Escoffier flourish, you know. But for the most part, I just don't take the amount of time it takes. It was kind of a treat to take that amount of time to make food.
Most of us can't invest that kind of time.
Every day you're just not going to do it.
You know? But you know, we only have a couple minutes left. But you know, you end your book talking about Le Guide from Escoffier as Le Guide Culinaire from Escoffier as being sort of an argument for biodiversity and preserving the planet. And you know, you're no vegetarian tree hugger. You're a hunting tree hugger, and so are we. So, why don't you talk about that? How do you think this book argues for biodiversity on the planet?
Well, first off, you know, having never met Escoffier, I can't officially say this, but he would probably not know what we were talking about if we were talking about biodiversity. It wasn't on his mind. That's just something that someone in a contemporary position would get from looking at it, because within this story, like Escoffier cooked with a lot of passenger pigeons, okay? And, you know, they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
We lost them.
Right, they don't exist anymore.
Yeah, and so when you think about that for a long time, it was just like an enjoyable treat to now and then have a passenger pigeon, you know, as food. You wish that we had gone and somehow handled ourselves a little differently,
mm-hmm.
you know, and found a way to sustainably coexist with something, you know,
I guess,
rather than just like being so extravagant.
I guess
going through the book and looking at things that maybe are not so abundant anymore, or things that are still abundant, or substitutes for things, you just kind of get a sense that you want the world to be sort of as big and as beautiful as it can be.
Wow.
And that sense for me comes very much just from being around animals and seeing animals and having the occasion to eat them and sort of enjoy what they bring. I mean, when you buy a piece of chicken, someone somewhere killed that. So,
you know,
of course, you're arguing you have to do it yourself, but that's where it came from. And it's just
Steven,
nice to have all the availability.
We're going to have to leave it there because we're coming to the end of the segment, but I want to thank you for being on our show. You were great. It was great to have you.
Hey, I had a great time talking to you guys.
Thanks, Steven. We'll talk to you when a new book comes out.
Take care, man.
Thanks.
Steven Ornella. The book is The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine. Find out about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Pick it up and read it. And if you're really adventurous, try and cook a few of those things. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today was Steven Ornella. His book is The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine, which is him cooking 45 dishes out of Escoffier's book, the Guide Culinaire, or the Culinary Guide, which is Escoffier wrote pre-World War I,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote about stuff that you just don't see anymore, and I thought it was very interesting. It was a fascinating book. If you're interested in nature, it's fascinating. If you're interested in food, it's fascinating. If you're interested in Escoffier and the basics of cuisine that we now have, it's fascinating. And if you're interested in finding out about foods that we don't don't eat anymore, but that were an important part of our culinary tradition and history, it's a tremendous book.
Well, I'll tell you what I really enjoyed about the book and what I think is important about the book, and you and I get to talk about this a lot, is how separate we've become from our food. You know, food, your chicken comes as cleaned breast of chicken,
right.
that you fry up.
Ask my niece where chicken comes from. She'll tell you a box.
Right. Comes with a little styrofoam package underneath and plastic saran wrap around it. And I think that it's really interesting when you go all the way back and start from the live animal, butcher it yourself, and do that. There's something about making food that way that just gives you more respect for it makes you eat better, by definition.
I want to throw one more thing out there. In this era where we're embracing the very, very contemporary, you know, chefs at the forefront are embracing avant-garde cuisine,
mm-hmm.
you know, cuisine that is we're reinventing food, things that have never been done before. You know, I think we can look to Steven Ornella, and I think we can look to Escoffier, because there's all kinds of food that we don't eat anymore that's still available that we could look back, then that's mm-hmm. as interesting and shocking and striking and as new as this avant-garde cuisine. And finally, how he ends the book talking about biodiversity. It's just, you know, it's like the canary in the coal mine. you know, there are things that Escoffier writes about preparing for food that don't exist on the planet anymore.
Right.
Okay, when you start to look in the cookbook and say, now extinct.
Can't get that.
That should be a real bellwether for us. Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't be eating chicken 5 days a week and pasta the other 2 days a week because that's the only food we'll eat. You talk about there's a lot of food diversity out there, and it should be more balanced.
And let's eat the pigeons. That's what I'm all for.
Let's eat the pigeons.
Anyway, rather than just kill them, let's kill them and eat them. Anyway, well, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.